Hello, I'm Jane Crowther, editor of Total Film, and welcome to Inside Total Film, which is the weekly podcast from the Smarter Movie Magazine. And today I'm joined by our news editor, Jordan Farley.
Hello.
And our contributing editor, Mr. James Mottram.
Hello.
Hello, James. So this week we're talking about The Fast and the Furious 9, Supernova and Sweat. And James is also going to tell us about bobbing about in a boat with Dwayne Johnson. But before we get onto those, let's have a little chat about what we've been watching this week. Chaps, what have you been feasting your eyes on this week?
I caught up with Luca on Disney Plus on Friday, which I thought was just delightful. A little bit minor in the grand scheme of Pixar films, but I found it a real kind of soothing balm after, you know, 15 months of hell and a very rainy week in the UK.
It was quite lovely.
Right? Yeah, exactly. And, you know, also on Disney Plus, of course, I've been keeping up with Loki. The MCU series. I have to say, I was slightly underwhelmed by the first episode. Felt a tiny bit clumsy for Marvel to me, but I really enjoyed episode two. I thought it kind of found its groove a bit more in episode two. And Owen Wilson, of course, can't get enough of him.
Yeah, I think he's outperforming old Hiddleston really in this, isn't he?
He's running away with it at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah.
He really is.
What have you been watching, James?
Well, I've also been keeping up with Loki. I very much enjoyed Owen's contribution. And I've also been watching some old documentaries, slightly strangely, some old Nick Broomfield documentaries from 1991, The Leader, His Driver and the Driver's Wife, which is about a South African right-wing extremist. Don't ask me why I decided to catch up with that one, but I have been quite enjoying some old Nick Broomfield. I think it's because he's got a new film coming out. It's early Nick with, you know, he's just sort of just about getting into the whole, you know, on-camera style that he became famous for, and getting into this quite dangerous situation with this South African guy, Eugene Terre Blanche. So I would advise people to seek it out.
Yeah.
Sounds great. Good.
Yeah. Should we talk about something that's not quite as grounded as that then? Let's talk about a film that Total Film models its office dynamic on. We live by the family ethos of this franchise. So here we go. It's pedal to the metal and foot to the floor. It's this.
So we're up against a master thief, assassin, high performance driver. Who is he?
Jacob is Dom's brother.
So this is Fast 9, and there's a brother involved, James. Set it up for us. How has Dom's brother turned up? Just as Letty came back from the dead, these things can happen even on episode 9. Tell us where we are with this.
I want to know how many other Toretto relatives there are in the woodwork. But early on, we get to see a flashback to their youth, Dom and his brother Jacob. There's been a little bit of discord between the siblings. As the story continues, Dom is now with his young son. He's living a quiet farmer life. He's sort of got the dungarees and the pitchfork. And of course, he gets called back into the old life. Mr. Nobody, the Kurt Russell spook that's appeared in the last couple of films, has gone missing. Basically, he sent out a signal to draw in Dom and his crew. So of course, they have to go into the middle of nowhere with some cars and go looking for him. And that brings him back into the orbit of his brother, Jacob, played by John Cena. They're all looking for this crazy MacGuffin called Project Ares, which it has something to do with destroying computers or something along those lines. It really is quite unclear, but it's obviously very dangerous and needs to be found immediately. And it goes on from there. You know, the brothers going mano a mano, basically. Of course, there'll be some old characters that will be turning up from the franchise just to sort of increase this sort of wonderful operatic soap opera. It's classic, crazy, Fast and Furious soap opera plotting.
Yeah. I mean, Jordan, you love this, don't you?
I love the Fast films, yeah. And I did, I have to say, I did really enjoy this. Although I had a bit of a kind of a left brain, right brain thing going on with this film, because, you know, the one hemisphere of my brain was like a man stumbling across water in the desert after like 30 days, where I was just giddy with excitement to see things like explode on a cinema screen once again, because it's just
been
so long.
Cars and rocket.
Exactly, exactly. It just gets so stupid. They're like flipping trucks that are like about a mile long, and they're like rope swinging across canyons with cars, and it's just beyond stupid. Like, which was 100% what that one side of my brain wanted from this film. You know, as James said, I love that they're built on this like earnest, emotional bedrock of found family, and they just take themselves quite seriously in that respect. And that they have these overarching narratives that reward commitment to the series with these like wild twists that completely recontextualize things you saw like four films earlier. Like, it's just mad ambitious for a film on this sort of scale to even do that.
But I sense
the but is coming. But I will say I gave this 3 stars a total film, so I in no way dislike this film. Like, I very much enjoyed it. But I would say the slightly more, you know, critical and rational side of my brain did have a few issues with it. I would start out by saying I much preferred 9 to 8. I thought 8 was just like far too dour for my liking for a fast film. This one brings the fun back. You know, it's Justin Lin directing again, who of course helmed all the Fast films from Tokyo Drift to Fast 6. He really gets these films like no one else, I think. He knows how to bring the fun out in them. And, you know, he handles the set pieces better than I think anyone who's ever directed a Fast film. Like, he really knows how to handle the action. Some of the stuff that it brought to the series I quite liked, like the flashbacks. I thought they were handled pretty well. And they gave a kind of decent amount of background to Dom as a character, which we haven't had a lot of, despite there being like 9 films in the series to this point. Like, we don't know a great deal about him before, you know, he was on the scene in the very first film. Spectacular set pieces, of course. I absolutely love the use of electromagnets in this film. You know, completely physics defying, nothing grounded in science whatsoever, but they use them in such creative ways. It really reminded me of that final set piece in Fast 5 where they're dragging the safe around.
Yeah.
And just really having fun with the concept, like he has that with the electromagnets here. My sort of big issue with it was the introduction of the brother, really. One, it's just a ridiculous retcon that we've never heard of Jacob until this point. Like, how has no one mentioned him like 8 films in? And the other thing is, like, I just didn't believe Vin Diesel and John Cena were brothers. Like, they look nothing alike. They don't behave in ways that resemble each other in any way. It just felt like a real stretch to believe.
But they both have big muscles, and that's
they have enormous muscles. Of course, huge. They're related.
Yes,
big chins, enormous muscles. Yeah,
they even make a reference to his chin at one point, I think. And their sort of multiracial sort of lineage. So, of course, that line itself clears up all of the concerns you have, I think.
Yes. Well, yeah. Why are you dwelling on the genetics, Jordan? I mean, really, of course they're brothers.
It was more just like, I mean, come on. Is anyone buying them as brothers? Like, not really. But him as a character, I thought he wasn't one of the better Fast villains, I didn't think. If you have like, you know, Jason Statham's Deckard Shaw is like the high watermark of Fast villains. He was like hovering way lower than that for me. He was just like a bit of a sad sack, really. Like, he was just so like depressed all the way through that he wasn't like part of the family anymore. It's like, oh, can someone just give this guy a hug already? Like,
he just needs like a cup of tea and a sort of gentle talking to, maybe.
Exactly.
Did it work for you, James? Were you like bothered about that sort of thing?
I wasn't actually bothered about the brother issue. I got sort of slightly tangled in the second half. I won't go into sort of plot details, but I sort of paused in my brain and said, where are we in the world exactly at the moment as all this craziness was going on? I literally completely lost what they were doing, why they were doing it. It didn't really matter because the craziness of the stunts is what you're there for. I kind of preferred the first half. I have to admit, there's a minefield sequence early on, which is absolutely incredible. And that was so pure Fast and Furious. And it was, again, that thing of being back in the cinema and watching something completely demented. And that it was so brilliantly directed, that sequence as well. There's also a great chase in Edinburgh. They pop up in good old lovely Edinburgh at one point, which, you know, made me slightly nostalgic for going to Edinburgh.
You know, you've got to do a bit of the film in the UK for the tax breaks, right?
I would agree with Jordan. It was definitely better than Fast 8, which was, as you said, very sort of dour. So I did have fun. I thought it was getting pretty close to jumping the shark by the end. I won't go into specifically what happens. But then again, I thought, isn't Fast and the Furious always about jumping the shark?
I was going to say, like, isn't that what
And they get away with it.
Yeah. It's so bombastic and so sort of sure of itself that it does it and it allows you to go, yeah, that's dumb. And I'm happy with it. If you actually, you know, stripped back these films and criticised them properly, there's really very little to recommend them. They've got ridiculous dialogue, as you say, stupid narratives, nonsensical science. But that's not the point of them, is it?
No. I really liked as well, Jordan mentioned the flashbacks, and there's one sequence that takes you back to the original sort of street racing ideas that the first film was really built on. And I really like that. And also the guy who plays the young Dom, his name's Vinny Bennett. I don't really know him from other stuff, but I thought he was really good and charismatic. And I thought we're going to see him in something else in the future. I think he's going to be big.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if they bring more young Dom and Jacob into the next film, given how successful they are.
Well, maybe it's an offshoot like Hobbs and Shaw. Just get the before times. we also get Charlize Theron back in as, a very natty dressed baddie. Did we like her?
I'm going to sound like very dour here. I will preface this by saying I really enjoyed this film. It's just that I hold my Fast films to like a way higher standard than most of the people do. Because I think like 5 and 7 are absolutely amazing. Like they're two of my favorite action films like the last 10 years. I thought Charlize was like completely wasted in this film. She sort of serves a Hannibal Lecter role where she's just stuck in a jail cell for most of the film and just like...
But a Perspex one.
A Perspex one, so you can, you know, see her clearly. Yeah. But she has this very weird kind of exchange of dialogue in the middle of the film where there's like this weird Star Wars metaphor going on, and it goes on for about 2 minutes. And it just felt like, why is this in this film? Like, this should have been cut at the script stage. Like, I had no idea how it made it into the finished edit. Very bizarre and flat. And they just felt like they didn't really know what to do with her in this film. Because she's like this ultra hacker who... Yeah. You give her a computer, she's basically unstoppable. So they just have to keep her like isolated in this cell with nothing to do. Otherwise, she just gets out and causes havoc. So they're really kind of written themselves into a corner by just how powerful a character she is. And then there's like another sort of villainous character who's the kind of son of this dictator who's just basically there to bankroll John Cena's character and doesn't really serve any other purpose otherwise. My biggest disappointment was what they do with Tyrese Gibson's character in this, Roman Pierce, because there's this weird running gag about how he believes he's invincible and he can't be killed. It's kind of this meta joke about how everyone in this franchise is basically bulletproof and hasn't been hurt until this point. But like James says, they basically jump the shark with that joke. Like they just push it way too far to the point where you're almost like, is this some kind of fourth wall breaking thing? Like, is like Deadpool going to stick his head around the corner in a minute? Like, what the hell's going on? It's very, very bizarre. I admire that they're trying to push things and do things fun and different, but that didn't quite work for me.
I do wonder where on earth they're going to go next after
space.
That.
Oh, God, yeah.
Space or deep underground, probably on an Elon Musk space traveler or something, isn't it? Knocking other ships out the sky.
Literally all they can do is become like a space opera or something, like turn in like a Chronicles of Riddick crossover or something.
Like, and the only direction himself. They can go. Like, Dom could meet like Riddick in space. There you go.
I mean, this strange rumors about a Fast and Jurassic crossover. I think that's been doing the rounds on Twitter. I think that I'm hoping that's a joke, but you know, you never know.
I'm hoping it's real. Come on, that would be amazing. But this film does obviously sell because there are going to be two more films. Two final films of the Fast Saga, as it's called now. And this film obviously does set up a little bit where we're going from here. So most notably in the form of Han Solo, Sung Kang's character, who, you know, I won't go into spoilers about how he is back in this film, but he is back and sort of semi-underutilized here, I think.
Sorry. Han Solo?
Yeah, that's what he's called.
He's actually called Han Solo?
Yeah, it's just
how
a gag,
have I missed
basically.
This? How have I missed this, that his surname is that? I just know him as Han. Oh my God, that's even more special, isn't it? Carry on, as you were.
That's clearly where the Star Wars metaphor came from.
I mean, Fast is just the series that keeps giving. There's just so many layers to it. jokes within jokes. But yeah, I was just going to say that his character is not particularly well used here, I don't think. He kind of turns up and doesn't really do a great deal. I think because they're setting him up to do more interesting things in future films. And if you stick around for a very enticing mid-credit scene, you'll get a hint at kind of the direction his character might be going in. Mm-hmm. That's all I'll say.
That mid-credit scene was great, actually, have to say. It was good to see Mia, the Jordana Brewster character, finally have something to do in a proper action sequence, which is quite rare. She's normally sidelined. So that was nice. And obviously, she clearly being Dom's sister and clearly Jacob's sister as well. So that was nice that there was more interaction for her, I thought, in this film.
Yeah, Mia and Letty have a ton more to do in this film. You know, Letty is often sidelined in these films, and she's basically like the second lead behind Dom Toretto. And there's a whole sequence where Letty and Mia go off to Tokyo on their own kind of separate mission. And that was really cool. There's sort of a great fight sequence in the middle of that. I wouldn't say it's the most convincing Tokyo set I've ever seen.
I did feel that myself. I was thinking, where have they got those sort of nice little flags and things from? Some noodles and stuff like that.
Yeah, exactly. But I was so glad just to see them get to do their own thing away from the boys. Like, that stuff all worked really, really well for me.
Now, Jordan, you did the cover feature for us when we thought it was coming out many moons ago. Whenever we do these interviews, they always talk a good talk about the film and what it is and what it represents for the franchise. So bearing in mind what they told you, do you think they've done a good job? What were they trying to sell us on it?
John Cena told me that the action in this film would, not me specifically, but the action in this film would make you crap your pants. And I think he was pretty much on the money. Like, I didn't actually crap myself, but
good to know.
Incredible action. Like, if you're going to see this film for any reason, go see it, because it's just pure spectacle and just the kind of thing that you only get from that proper big screen experience. You know, Vin is very much the earnest one. He takes these films very seriously. He knows that you have to have fun, but he's very invested in the story and the lore and the arc of Dom Toretto as a character. So he was all in on like what this film means for Dom as a character. I'm not sure like the emotional journey was there entirely. I felt like a lot of the heavy lifting was actually done by the younger actors in the flashbacks. And Vin was just left to kind of ride on their coattails a tiny bit. But I still enjoy Vin's performance as Dom. I still think that having this super earnest performance in the middle of this incredibly daft film is just a weird incongruous thing that somehow works. I'm glad that these films are still around and they're still going 9 films in.
Yeah. Well, as they always say, it's all about family. So I don't know why I said it in a Cockney way, because they're not that.
Well, that was Helen Mirren.
Helen Mirren. Yeah, exactly.
Who pops up in this film and in a very enjoyable sequence, I thought. Yeah. She seems to be having just the time of her life in these
films.
With
an accent that no one from the East End has ever had before or since. I love it. I feel like she made a choice with that as well. She's like, yeah, none of this is real. None of this could ever happen in real life. So therefore, my accent's not going to be remotely like anything you've ever heard. Go love a duck. So I think we're saying go see this, right?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah,
definitely. Hits the spot.
It hits the spot. Okay. So that is Fast 9, and that is out in cinemas today on Thursday. Get your popcorn, get in there. Okay. So shall we move on to a less sedate pace and a less sedate vehicle? It's this.
So can you tell that it's gotten worse? I'd like to make a speech. Maybe Sam will do it for me.
I'd love you to do it for me. Now, as most of you will know, I am slowly losing my ability to remember. And I definitely wouldn't be here if it weren't for this man next to me.
I want to be remembered for who I was, but not for who I'm about to become.
Okay, so this is Supernova, which was another one that was supposed to be out quite a few months ago, but has been hopping around in the release schedule. And this is a very sort of smaller scale story than the Fast movies, about a couple who have been together for many years, starring Colin Firth and Stanley Tucci, who are on a holiday in the Lake District in a camper van because one of them is suffering a debilitating disease and is starting to have problems with their memory and mental awareness. And it's a sort of push-pull story of what it's like to be the person that's losing someone in that situation, and also what it's like to be the person that is losing their sense of self. It's a lovely film, I thought, and very delicately done. Jordan, you spoke to the director of this film a long time ago. What was he trying to achieve with it?
He used to be a care worker, and a lot of the reality of the sort of young onset dementia that's in the film actually comes from some of his own experiences. So I think first and foremost, he wanted to put an authentic depiction of that, you know, horrible, debilitating illness on screen. But this idea of kind of a mature gay romance, which isn't kind of rooted in melodrama, it's just based purely in this love for these two people that have been together for probably most of their adult lives, that kind of went hand in hand with that. It was a way for him to explore this idea of dementia on screen, which is, you know, quite interesting because we just had The Father, you know, the film that Anthony Hopkins won an Oscar for, which explores dementia in one way, which was to completely immerse you in the experience of dementia in the best way that cinema could, by kind of recreating that experience through editing and moving sets around and things like this. But this film is more about the emotional journey of the characters, and you are viewing dementia almost as a bit of an outsider, more from Sam's perspective, who is Colin Firth's character, who has to care for Tusker, who is the one who is suffering from this illness. It's a very interesting companion piece to The Father in that it tackles the same subject matter, more or less, from a completely different perspective. And I have to say, I found this a much more emotional film than The Father. The Father almost works as a horror film. Like, it's quite like scary at times to be in. But this, I was just, it was really just tugging on my heartstrings throughout. I was just profoundly moved by the end. There's a sort of sequence towards the end where they have a big heart-to-heart over a dinner table. And I was in like absolute floods in that scene. Like, it was so just profoundly affecting. And the performances are just wonderful. Like, especially Stanley Tucci. They originally spoke about these two actors doing these roles the other way around. So Colin Firth would be the one suffering from dementia and Stanley Tucci would be the one caring for him. But I think it works so much better this way around because there's something like quite upsetting seeing Stanley Tucci be the one who's suffering in this way, because we're used to him being sort of so composed and on the ball. Like, it's quite horrible to watch.
I can't imagine that those two playing the roles the other way around.
Once you've seen it, definitely.
Yeah, it does seem like it suits them so much. This sort of emotional heft for me comes from this idea of losing them at the same time of having them. So some days they're completely there and completely themselves, and other days they've already gone. And it's like this mourning process that you have daily when they're still with you, but not with you, but yet burning brightly at some moments. And, you know, as you say, they have this amazing party and Tusker is absolutely himself and firing on all cylinders, but then he can get lost in a car park the next day. That losing of somebody, the sort of fading of somebody, is almost worse possibly than them being taken immediately. And it sort of explores that, doesn't it? The idea of having to see someone deteriorate is so, so painful. It's interesting as well that you mentioned the horror aspect of The Father, because obviously we had Relic as well, which dealt with dementia in an actual horror genre. But again, that was incredibly moving because of that immense sadness that it's for the people that are left behind, that know you, can see the real you, and then are also seeing the deteriorated version as well. I talked to both Stanley Tucci and Colin Firth about this, and they're obviously very good friends in real life. So I do think that also adds this amazing layer of authenticity to this relationship, that you really do feel they love and care for each other, and that they'd be bereft if one was gone. And they're as delightful in real life as they are on this film. I mean, you know, we're talking about it in these horrible terms, but it's actually funny as well, isn't it? And sort of quirky and amusing in places as well. I mean, the two of them driving this camper van, which they really did drive, and Colin Firth took the gate off the house that they were filming in by mistake because he wasn't that good at driving it. All of those sort of elements are sort of very sweet as well. Did you enjoy it, James?
Yeah, I mean, you used at the beginning of your intro the word delicate, and that's exactly what this film is. It's very sensitive, and is it only his second film, is that right? Harry McQueen's second film, I believe?
Yeah, I think so.
Incredibly impressive for a sort of, you know, in an early part of his career to be that assured with those two actors. I mean, obviously, as you said, it really helps that they're friends. You feel like that relationship has been lived in. It's just such a sort of subtle portrayal of that long-term relationship and the pain of losing someone. I mean, you've both mentioned the father. God, I would not want to see a double bill of this film and the father. That is the double bill I least want to see in my life.
Yeah, a whole packet of tissues for that.
Despite how impressive both films are. And it is amazing they've come in the same sort of 6 months as well, in tackling the same subject, both impressively, but in such different ways. I mean, you've mentioned the dinner party scene. We can't really go into what happens in that scene, but God, that is a devastating scene to watch. It really is.
Yes. Yeah. But equally, there's some beautiful, you know, Cumbrian countryside on display as well. I mean, if you don't want to sort of wallow in the really sadness of it, there's a lot of lovely holiday porn going on as well in this one, isn't there?
So shut your ears and just watch it then, basically.
Yeah.
Listen
to what... Yeah, just look at the Crummock water. Looks gorgeous, doesn't it?
You need a holiday, Jane. You need to get out, basically.
Can you tell I'm really desperate to go away?
Are you going to be renting an RV and driving around the lake soon then?
Not on those narrow roads, because as we saw in that film, that's quite hairy trying to get a large vehicle down those roads. But yeah, I do sort of like that sort of very English comedy, you know, like where they tease each other as well. There's a lot of teasing in this relationship that feels very realistic as well. And I believe that that was sort of written in additionally, because that's the nature of the Tucci-Firth relationship as well. And certainly when they're in a room together, they take the piss out of each other relentlessly. I just thought it was delightful.
I mean, he just can do no wrong. I mean, he's obviously been a complete lockdown hero with his...
Martini making,
exactly. The range of performances he's done over the years is just incredible. I mean, if you think of something like Spotlight, for example, he just seems to get better with age. He's just one of those actors, and just he's on full throttle. He is supernova here, basically. He's going supernova.
Yeah, burning very, very brightly. Okay, so I think we can highly recommend that one as well. That is out this Friday, and it's Supernova. And do go to the cinema, but do take your tissues with your popcorn. So it's now time for alternative line reading. Are you ready? I'm going to do a line, and I want you to tell me which film this is from. I haven't decided how I'm going to do it.
We should do it like Dominic Toretto.
Okay. I realized that when I met you at the turkey curry buffet, I was unforgivably rude and wearing a reindeer jumper.
I wasn't sure if that was Dom or like Robert De Niro or something. So you're saying it's not Goodfellas then, is what you're saying?
It is not. They don't have a turkey curry buffet in Goodfellas.
It's not Bridesmaids, is it?
Nope.
I think I do know what this is, actually. I'm pretty sure it's the first Bridget Jones film. Is that right?
Correct. It's Colin Firth one.
Yeah, I thought it was, because I just remember his terrible reindeer jumper from that party.
Yeah. And it really sounded like this.
I realized that when I met you at the turkey curry buffet that I was unforgivably rude and wearing a reindeer jumper that my mother had given me the day before.
Okay, shall we move on to our other regular, which is plain talking, which is where we demystify phrases that are used on set that we never know what they're talking about. We've had to work out over the years of set visits. And the one we're going to talk about today is MOW, which you'll see on a call sheet. And if you don't know what a call sheet is, that is the sheet that says who is going to be on set that day, what time their pickup is, what time they'll be on set, and what time they need to be ready for rolling camera. And underneath someone's name, it might say MOW. What does it mean?
If I remember correctly, it means they're making their own way to set. Is that right?
It is.
Yeah. So basically, if you might have like a hired car or something that's arranged for the talent, as they like to say, Or they might just be driving in themselves. Or if they're super cool, they might be riding in on a motorbike. Yeah. Or they might be running in if they want to get their morning jog in on the way to set. Typically, the press are kind of like shipped in on a bus, like the party bus in the morning after a meal the night before. Their transportation will all be arranged. But I guess it's up to the people involved how they want to get into set in the morning.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, call times on set are generally hideously early because people have to get into hair and makeup. They're often picked up at sort of 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. I mean, if I was a star, I would want to be getting myself there. I would love it if a person came to my door and I turned up, got in the car, put a little pillow on the seat and napped on my way to work. That would be the dream. But some of them do like to make their own way. And I have to say, it's very exciting if you get on the call sheet. On a couple of film sets where we've been there, I have been on the call sheet very, very low down. And it does say MOW next to me because obviously I'm not getting a car.
But you might also be filming in a country or a place in your own country that you've never been to before and you have no idea where you are, and you might be so remote that you don't even have a signal. Like, I can't imagine like Leo was making his own way to set on like The Revenant, you know?
No.
Like, he was surely getting picked up for that.
Yes, like, and helicoptered in.
Yeah, exactly. Like, Tom Cruise probably makes his own way to set every day. He'll helicopter his way in. He'll just jump in the chopper in his driveway.
As we know from his recent excursions around North Yorkshire, he just helicopters himself to set. Have you ever been on a call sheet, James?
Normally it would just say journalist. I'm not sure I've actually had my own name printed on there. But even then, you always slightly worry when it says journalist because you think, oh my God, are the talent going to run a mile?
But yeah.
Did you frame your call sheet with your name on it?
I did keep it because I found it very exciting. Yes. Number one was Eddie Redmayne and two was Felicity Jones. And then very, very far down was me. So it was very exciting.
Did you make your own way in a hot air balloon?
I wish I had. I should have, shouldn't I? But no, I did go via train, I believe, which was less salubrious.
They should arrange film appropriate transportation to set. Like, if you work on a fast film, you should get to get
Lamborghini
to stay in like a Dodge Charger every day, like at 100 miles an hour.
I'm totally into this. Yeah,
that would be awesome.
Yeah, but I don't know that I wouldn't have enjoyed Revenant transport though if you were on set of that. That would
have crawl through the mud.
Please sleep in your horse carcass and then crawl to set the next morning freezing cold. Thanks. Not for me. Anyway, shall we move on then to our final film this week? We're going to make you work for it. It's this.
Kochani, na pewno znacie ten moment, kiedy budzicie się, a wasze ciało jeszcze śpi, a umysł śni. Sprzedam wam w tym momencie najlepszy sposób na poranny, przyjemny trening.
So this is Sweat, which was at Cannes last year, wasn't it, Jordan?
Yeah, I mean, it would have been if Cannes had actually happened, but it was one of the, supposedly one of the films that played at Cannes last year, yeah. So this is Swedish director Magnus von Horn's second feature. It stars Magdalena Kolesnik as Sylvia, an Instagram fitness influencer in Poland with 600,000 followers. The film is set over, I think it's 2 or 3 days, during which we see sort of Sylvia's public persona in full force during this group workout in a shopping center where she's surrounded by, you know, screaming, adoring fans. But very quickly after that, the film kind of settles down into a very unexpected groove, I thought. She's single and intensely lonely, something which she confesses in this teary video on Instagram that goes viral. And there are all sorts of headlines about it. She's being stalked by a man who parks outside a building and watches her and does all sorts of unsavory things in his car. Mm. She goes to her mother's house for a birthday party where her celebrity sort of means nothing and her problems aren't really taken seriously. And it all builds towards this opportunity she has to perform on Breakfast TV the following morning for what I'm sure is a huge audience. So I thought, as a sort of first stab at a quote-unquote film that humanizes influencers, I thought this was pretty decent, actually. I thought Sylvia as the character was well-rounded. She seems to be in it for the right reasons. Like, they don't portray her as like an obnoxious fame chaser who's just in it for the money and the glory. She's in it to kind of make people's lives better and make them feel healthier. And, you know, at one point she threatens to stop using this firm that's supplying her meals because they're not using, like, they're using plastic instead of like eco packaging. So you're like, oh, she kind of has a head screwed on straight. It's not positioning her as like a figure of ridicule. She's just someone who's, you know, found a way to make people's lives better through social media effectively. And I really liked where the film went in its final third. I don't want to get into it too much, but the stalker is like closely involved. And it didn't go in a direction that I thought it would, which I kind of admired about it. It's all shot very naturalistically. It's not doing like a kind of Mitchells versus the Machines thing where it's like adopting the language of social media or anything and doing fast edits and filters and stuff. It's all very like grounded and very much like a film you would expect to see at a film festival like Cannes, all handheld, very traditional kind of cinematography. Great looking, but the direction felt more sort of functional than flashy to me. The only thing I struggled with a bit was, obviously it's a small story. Don't go in like expecting Fast Nine levels of grandiose emotions, you know, or even supernova levels of emotions. And the fact that Sylvia is obviously like quite a privileged person. She's clearly quite wealthy. She's on the cover of magazines. She's basically a minor celebrity in this world. But there wasn't a thorough explanation of why she was so sad and why she didn't have any friends and why she was single. Like,
yeah,
I know,
you think that was the thing. That's the thing I found quite interesting about it. I didn't know even till the end whether, you know, this sadness that she goes through was real or a ploy to gain more interest and followers and was part of her persona. And I liked that sort of enigmatic quality of it, that I really didn't know what was up with her. And maybe that was the point.
We don't see her interact with anyone except business partners and her family, basically, which I think you're supposed to take from that, that she is basically alone. Like, she doesn't have anyone to rely on or speak to that isn't a fan, basically.
Yeah.
But I totally get where you're coming from. Like, I think very deliberately, it doesn't give you a great deal of context for her life. Like, you don't know what her upbringing was like, really. You don't know if she had friends growing up or if she is friendless and single now because of who she is, like because of her fame, because she has this job. Has that isolated her from people, or was she always this way? Like, it was quite compelling kind of unpicking that character and trying to work out exactly what was going on.
There's this amazing scene, as you say, where she goes home to see her mother and sort of various family members come around. She dresses up beautifully. She takes presents. She thinks that the celebrity element's going to happen there. And in fact, the most celebrated person at the table is a member of the family who's pregnant. And that's more to celebrate than her having 600,000 followers. And her mother sort of has all these microaggressions towards her. And so you start to wonder, you know, is she craving some sort of validation through the screen that she didn't get growing up? You know, is that the source of her sadness, or is it precisely because of that that she's a success through the screen? Because that's how she communicates with people. She calls everyone my loves, you know, I've just done this workout, or I'm just making a shake. And she doesn't do anything in her life that isn't documented for the purposes of consumption. And it feels like she tries to do that at this meal as well, that the thing she says at the dining room table is for consumption and to get a reaction and to get literal likes within the room, and she doesn't get that feedback, so that's not satisfying to her. I found it absolutely fascinating. Did you, James?
Yeah, I did. I actually spoke to Magnus von Horn for the film, and he actually sort of followed real fitness influencers. That's where the idea came from. I really liked his interest in sort of Instagram, because he's kind of like me. He said he's quite voyeuristic and sort of will follow people, but agonizes over posting anything, which I can completely relate to, I have to say. I think Jordan's completely right. It really is a very credible portrayal, and it doesn't just go for the jugular. She is a well-rounded character. That's what I liked about it. I've got to say, it made me feel incredibly unfit as well.
Yes.
I was almost encouraged to get off the sofa after that sort of early sequence where she's in the shopping mall and she's got all her fans around her. I almost wanted to start getting up and jumping up and down. It's quite funny that this film's around at the same time as Physical, which is this new Apple TV show with Rose Byrne, where she's playing an aerobics instructor from the 1980s. I don't know what the television's trying to tell me at the moment. Perhaps that I'm desperately unfit.
I think you need to get your Jane Fonda out and do some, you know, star jumps and crunches and things.
Exactly. Get my leotard.
Oh, yeah.
The other bit of cinematic synergy with this film is that there's that Andrew Garfield film, Mainstream, coming out later this year, which is in the same way that The Father and Supernova were kind of thematically connected, but two different sides of the same coin. Like Mainstream and Sweat are basically the two sides of the kind of Instagram influencer celebrity side of the coin, where in this, it's a very credible portrayal. It's very grounded. This is a very human character. Whereas in Mainstream, it really goes for the, you know, obnoxious, fame-hungry kind of monster side of it all. So it's interesting that we've got two very different takes on the same kind of subject matter.
Yeah. There's also another little scene where she meets a school friend, doesn't she? And sits down with a school friend and she's sort of saying, we know that she's holding this sadness of being alone. And yet the school friend has actually had a much greater tragedy. And she sort of doesn't know how to compute that at all. So it's really interesting as a character study and really interesting as reflecting us back at ourselves and how we use social media and what we think about the people that we follow on social media. And this idea that they're having this fabulous life, this perky, fabulous life full of product that they're showing you all the new stuff they've got. And actually the sort of emptiness that that might possibly be hiding. I mean, there's a scene where she goes to a party and she doesn't speak to anyone. She's got no friends. She just floats through this party alone, but makes sure she takes these Instagram pictures of herself looking amazing in mirrors and all of that, so that if you're following her, it would look fabulous. But is that fabulous, going to a party and speaking to no one? I just think it's interesting.
As soon as she walks into that party, she's kind of swamped by the paparazzi. Yeah. Like, she's clearly like very well known. It's just her exterior life is just so different from the life that she's actually living. Yeah.
She just has digital and virtual friends and no actual physical friends.
Yeah. And is that like the cost of being an influencer? Like, if you're so dedicated to your public persona, like, do you even have a private persona? Like, are they separate? Are they the same? Like, is one sacrificed on the altar of the other? Like, even though this is a fairly small scale film, you know, a lot of it's set in like an apartment block and a house, and that's basically it. It still feels like it's tackling some quite big ideas, which is to its credit.
Very stylishly made as well. I mean, it really looks good. It completely suits the subject matter. I was really impressed with it, actually, as I'm assuming a fairly low budget feature. It was you can see why Cannes picked it up for last year's selection.
Yeah, and more importantly, it features two Roxette songs.
Very good point.
One of the other things I was really impressed by as well was the way that Van Horn shoots Sylvia as well, because there's a version of this film which could be quite leery and voyeuristic because she, you know, she's
amazing
instructor.
Looking. She has this amazing hair. She looks like a doll, doesn't she?
Exactly. She's absolutely beautiful. But, you know, he shoots a lot of it like quite close on her face. Like, she's performing these workout routines a lot, but it's very rare that you just get a wide shot of her even doing the exercises, even though, you know, I know from your interview with the director, James, that the actress, she worked out for like a year ahead of this film and like really got into exceptional shape for it. So it's not like she couldn't do it. It was just that those were the choices he made as a filmmaker for this not to be, you know, male gazy and leery. Like, it was very much about her interior mental life than it was about her physical side for the most part.
Yeah,
I think she went like sort of reverse Robert De Niro in Raging Bull, where she kind of lost a ton of weight. Yeah, I mean, she spent over a year in that character, sort of preparing not just the exercise, but creating her own Instagram persona. She hadn't really been on social media that much before, and the actress, that is, and, you know, then created this life exactly like the character. And I think you can really see in the performance that she's truly lived that role.
Yeah, brilliant. Okay, so this is Sweat, a fascinating film that will have you talking with your friends probably about your usage on social media. It's out on Friday in cinemas. Okay, so before we go, shall we talk about the new issue of Total Film, which is also on sale on Friday and features Jungle Cruise on its cover, the new Dwayne Johnson, Emily Blunt family adventure. And guess who was on set of that, Mr. Mottram?
I can guess, it was me.
Can you guess? Where did you... Tell us, where were you?
The beautiful Kauai in Hawaii, you know, Hawaii.
I mean,
the
it's a hard island, life.
Which is, you know, for any Jurassic Park fan as well, that is Jurassic Central. So I was very excited from that point of view. And, you know, this will come across in the feature when you buy your new copy of Titus,
which you will be buying because it's excellent.
But it was an absolutely incredible set. They sort of built this kind of early 1900s sort of Brazilian sort of port town. We sat and met with Mr. Johnson and others in a two-level bar that they built. There was a sort of whole port sequence. There were sort of, you could practically go and shopping in a market. It was an incredible piece of work that they put together. And it looks such fun as a film, I have to say. Truly looking forward to seeing it in its entirety. Dwayne Johnson was a true gentleman on set. As is often the case, they try and drag the talent away after about 2 minutes because they've got to go back and filming. And he was like, no, you've come all this way. You know, I'm going to sit here and talk. And he did. And he was a true gent.
He is one of the good ones, I have to say. I've interviewed him. And not only is he absolutely enormous in height and width, he really is a very sort of an understanding of what you need to do and how his job works with that as well. So yeah, I can imagine that he would appreciate that you traveled all the way to LA, swap planes, and then traveled another 6 hours to get to him, and would understand that maybe you'd want more than 2 minutes with him.
Exactly. Do you want a quick Jack Whitehall anecdote as well?
Go on then.
Which isn't in the feature. Jack was working out on set, and he was on an exercise bike, and he was watching 50 First Dates, would you believe? He managed to dislocate a rib while on an exercise bike watching 50 First Dates. So he was obviously hideously embarrassed that, you know, Dwayne Johnson was going to mock him. Apparently he didn't. Apparently he was very nice to him after that. But yeah, that was Jack's mishap on set.
I don't even know how that's possible.
I don't either. But he did it.
But actually, it's quite apt for his character because he is playing this rather sort of silly British toff all at sea in the jungle, isn't he? And he's aboard this boat that Dwayne's character is taking him and Emily Blunt upriver into the deep, dark jungle in pursuit of a flower that can heal everyone. I don't know.
The tree of life.
I don't really care, honestly. I would buy the ticket based on what you've told me.
I have to say, I'm very excited about this film because I absolutely love like The Mummy and Romancing the Stone and all those classic, you know, swashbuckling adventure films that people just don't seem to make anymore. And I'm sort of glad that they're giving it another go with this. I really hope it's good.
Yeah.
You've got Jesse Plemons as the villain as well.
Who's always great. Yeah.
Prince Joachim, I think he's called. He looks hilarious. You've got Paul Giamatti with a real-life cockatoo on his shoulder. I mean, what more can you want?
Yeah. I mean, it's got everything. Let's hope it is sort of tinged with a bit of Indiana Jones Romancing the Stone magic, because that sounds like the sort of thing I want to see this summer. But you can read more about it and what the actors and the producer and the director had to say about it in the issue, which is on sale on Friday. And if you're concerned about what it might look like, it's basically Dwayne Johnson and Emily Blunt swinging on a vine on the front cover. What more could you want? So for now, I think we'll say goodbye and go and check our Instagram, possibly. Do some exercise, James.
I've only got like 5 followers. It's not worth it.
I've got a salad to eat. Let's get to it.
If you could prod at that salad in a listless fashion with a giant fork like Sylvia, then we're good.
Yeah, make sure it's not in a plastic tub either.
Yeah, exactly. Eco-friendly all the way.
Exactly. So on that note, let's say goodbye.
Bye.
Goodbye.